Are we a declining race? An old sailor's verdict by Walter Hunt. Chapter 6, The Conservation of Vitality. Reason's whole pleasure, all the joys of sense, lie in three worlds, health, peace, and competence. But health consists of temperance alone, and peace, O virtue, peace is all thy own. Pope. Having placed the facts before the reader, it may seem unnecessary to prolong the discussion of a subject which must be distasteful to all, to none more so than myself. Yet it is of the first and last importance that no stone be left unturned to enlighten the public mind, however unthankful the task, and I would urge all to use their utmost endeavours to bring this matter to a successful issue. We are in a much more serious condition than is generally supposed. If the physical decline of the race were merely a social problem, and had been brought about by depressing conditions of labour and insufficient food, as so many authors seem to imagine, there would not be so much cause for alarm, as all these things might be, and no doubt will be, rectified in course of time by improved social measures. But it is a moral problem, and one which cannot at present be aired at any time or in any place, as all things pertaining to the public welfare should be, and it is thus rendered all the more difficult of solution. Before we can expect to make much headway, we must disabuse ourselves of the idea that we are so different, physiologically, from the lower animals, and that habits which would be decidedly detrimental to them may be indulged in with impunity by us. The idea that we are specially created beings has been the cause of much misunderstanding through which the race has had to suffer. Much harm has also been done by well-meaning writers who denounce the greatest of human virtues, chastity, as an unnatural sin. It is unnecessary to enumerate instances, but such statements have been made and supported by medical men. Their views have been largely accepted, and the result is obvious. Quote, "We emphatically condemn as a most pernicious doctrine, one calculated to work untold evil, and to foster the worst forms of vice, the theory that any injury whatsoever arises from a chaste celibacy. The organs are not weakened, nor their power lost, nor is there a tendency to spermatorrhea, nor to congestions, nor to any one of those ills which certain vicious writers and certain superficial and careless physicians have attributed to this state. No condition of life is more thoroughly consistent with perfect mental and physical vigour than absolute chastity." Close quote. G.H. Naffies, M.D., The Transmission of Life. These are not the words of a man likely to pander to public opinion. He has spoken the truth in an age when it is often considered the better policy to varnish one's sentences, to flatter the inclinations of an effete society. His statement is true. Our only hope of regaining a state of perfect health, perfect happiness, is by being chaste. Chastity is the conservation of that vital force which gives pleasure to life, and without which life is but a continuation of misery, disease, and suffering. To be chaste is one of the most simple things in the world, until nature is once violated, when it becomes one of the most difficult, both mentally and physically. Quote, "La continence absolue est minime relativement facile à ceux qui ne l'ont jamais effrayante car pour l'appareil génital, comme pour tous les autres appareils organiques, moins il est sollicité, moins il est impérieux." Close quote. Absence of this virtue has been the principal cause of the failure of civilization, as it has been the cause of ruin of all great empires, Egyptian, Persian, Greek, and Roman. The decline of the Roman Empire leaves little room for doubt as to its cause. The virtues of the Romans, quote, "soon disappeared amid the immorality and decomposition that mark the closing years of the Republic and the dawn of the Empire." the stern simplicity of life, which the censors had so zealously enforced, was exchanged for a luxury which first appeared after the return of the army of Manlius from Asia, increased to immense proportions after the almost simultaneous conquests of Carthage, Corinth, and Macedonia, received an additional stimulus from the example of Antony, and at last, under the empire, rose to excesses which the wildest Oriental orgies have never surpassed. From the History of European Morals, W. E. H. Lecky, M.A., Volume 1. It is not at all wonderful that under such conditions the Romans should have degenerated. Yet the effects of indulgence in these vices are so subtle that irreparable harm is done before it becomes known. And Gibbon says, quote, "It was scarcely possible that the eyes of contemporaries should discover in the public felicity the latent causes of decay and corruption. The long peace and the uniform government of the Romans introduced a slow and secret poison into the vitals of the empire." Close quote. From Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, Chapter 2. Socrates spoke in a similar manner of the Athenians. In a conversation with Pericles, according to Xenophon, he said that too great security was attended with carelessness, luxury, and disobedience. Quote, "After the Athenians saw themselves raised above the other Greeks, they indulged themselves in indolence and became at length degenerate." Close quote. Whatever were the vices of the barbarian races of Europe, licentiousness does not appear to have been very conspicuous at that time, for they were all chaste as compared with the Romans, and it was the constant influx of new blood which kept the Romans from total collapse. Quote, "The diminutive stature of mankind was daily sinking below the old standard, and the Roman world was indeed peopled by a race of pygmies when the fierce giants of the north broke in and mended the puny breed." Close quote. Gibbon. Amid the degradation of Rome, we meet with many noble efforts of reform by the philosophers of the time, but very little impression was made, superstition and vice being the supreme influences. Quote, "The criminal and frivolous pleasures of a decrepit civilization left no thought for the immediate duties of the day or the fearful trials of the morrow. Unbridled lust and unblushing indecency admitted no sanctity in the marriage tie. The rich and powerful established harems, in the recesses of which their wives lingered, neglected, and despised. The banquet, the theatre, and the circus exhausted what little strength and energy were left by domestic excesses. The poor aped the vices of the rich, and hideous depravity reigned supreme and invited the vengeance of heaven. Such rare souls as remained pure amid the prevailing contamination would naturally take refuge in the convent of severe ascetics and seek absolute seclusion from a world whose every touch was pollution." Close quote. H.C. Lee, Historical Sketch of Sacerdotal Celibacy, page 85. Quote, "Salvian must be heard in his denunciation against the licentiousness of the 5th century. Quote, "Among the chaste barbarians, we alone are unchaste. The very barbarians are shocked at our impurities. We cherish, they shrink from, incontinence. We shrink from, they are enamoured of, purity. Fornication, which with them is a crime and a disgrace, with us is a glory." Close quote. From the History of Latin Christianity, Dean Milman, Volume 1. The fact of these barbarians being chaste, as most authors seem to assert, speaks well for the principle of chastity, for they were known as very hardy races. They wore very scant clothing, their arms and legs being generally bare. Gibbon says, quote, "The barbarians of Germany, still faithful to the maxims of their ancestors, abhorred the confinement of walls, to which they applied the odious names of prisons and sepulchres." Close quote. In the laws of Theodoric, the German, adultery was a capital crime, and the seducer of a virgin was forced to marry her, also to endow her with a fifth of his estate. With the Goths, also, adultery was a capital crime, and irremissibly punished with death. Horace greatly commended the chastity of their women. Dean Milman, quoting Salvian, says, quote, "The Goths are treacherous, but continent." Close quote. These hardy people originated in Scandinavia and wore a garment of various colours, reaching to the knee. Their thighs, knees and legs were without any covering. Their sleeves only covered the tops of their arms. Fancy us going outside the door without a top coat on. Quote, "The Saxons are savagely cruel, but remarkable for chastity." Close quote. Milman, Volume 1. Quote, "There is, however, one feature in the manners of the ancient Saxons worthy of notice, the equality of rank which they allowed to women, and the chastity for which they were remarkable. The severest penalties were attached to every violation of female purity. Not only was adultery punished with a most horrible death, and a similar punishment awarded to the seducer, but even those familiarities between the sexes, which are generally esteemed innocent, were strictly prohibited to unmarried persons." Close quote. From the Religion of Ancient Britons, G.O. Smith, F.A.S. Dean Milman again quotes Bishop Salvianus in support of the character of barbarians. Quote, "The Vandals, if Salvian is to be credited, maintained their severe virtue, not only in Spain, but under the burning sun, and amidst the utter depravity of African morals, and in that state of felicity, luxury and wealth, which usually unmans the mind. They not only held in abomination the more odious and unnatural vices which had so deeply infected the habits of Greece and Rome, but all unlawful connections with the female sex. They enforced the marriage of public prostitutes and enacted severe laws against unchastity, thus compelling the Romans to be virtuous against their will." Close quote. And now I think I have brought sufficient evidence in support of the argument that pain and suffering, which includes physical degeneracy, so far from being the result of a rise in the scale of being, are the inevitable result of a fall. A fall not in the old theological sense of the term, but that each person of either sex falls from a state of physical perfection and moral purity on the surrender of virginity, and that the race has fallen through the effects of systematic indulgence in practices of a degrading nature. This seems to me the only way of tackling the question. We might go on for another century with the application of palliatives, still being as far from the solution as ever, the situation in the meantime becoming more complicated. We must strike at the root for real reform. Objections may be raised as to the advisability of publishing such information for the use of the general public, but my answer is that any vices not too vile to be practiced are not too vile to be denounced, and the more vile they are, the sooner the painful duty should be performed. If we knew that a deadly cobra lay concealed in a beautiful garden that people were passing through, we should not rest content with the hope that the people might all pass through without disturbing the reptile. We should first caution the people, and then proceed to kill the snake. The vices in question possess all the subtlety of the snake, and are just as deadly in their sting, so that it is our bounden duty to caution people of their venomous nature. Some may perhaps object that the importance of the problem is exaggerated, and that chastity, quote, "so far from being a virtue, is invariably a great natural sin," close quote, and, quote, "the morality which upholds virginity as a type of womanly perfection is unnatural," close quote. These statements have been made by persons who appeared to be thoroughly conscientious. Others are possessed with the idea that chastity has been the cause of many ailments, and for the reason of this confusion of ideas, we have not far to seek. Chastity and celibacy are terms which have frequently been used to mean the same thing. Thus, the confusion has arisen. Chastity means sexual purity, virginity, whereas celibacy means merely an unmarried state. A person may be celibate and yet be profligate, but it would be impossible for one to be profligate and still be chaste. The clergy have, perhaps, had most to do with the calumny brought on the fair name of chastity, for although pretending to lead lives of chastity, the clergy, as a body, were never chaste, and we read that, as a class, they were at times sunk far below the level of the laity. Says Lecky, quote, "The writers of the Middle Ages are full of accounts of nunneries that were like brothels, of the vast numbers of infanticides within their walls, and of the inveterate prevalence of incest among the clergy, which rendered it necessary again and again to issue the most stringent enactments that priests should not be permitted to live with their mothers and sisters." Close quote. From the History of European Morals, Volume 2. Is it to be wondered at that consumption, cancer, and such diseases should have found their way into such places, or that chastity should have borne the blame, for which debauchery and unnatural vices were really answerable? The apparently continent have ever been the greatest hindrance to the cause of chastity. Objections will never alter facts. We find ourselves in a very awkward predicament from which we must extricate ourselves. The only way is to put on a bold front, acknowledge our position, and make up our minds to live up to our light. Other nations have sunk under similar circumstances, and for many centuries have been unable to lift their heads. Let us prove equal to the occasion. We have the advantage of those that have gone before, for we are able to recognise where they failed, and are in a position to benefit by their experience. There is really no mystery in the whole problem. The great mistake which has been made in all civilised communities is that the importance of the sexual act has been ignored by the great majority. It has been surrounded with a halo of mystery, and free discussion of its properties has been discouraged or counted as indecent. And to make matters worse, young people are married without understanding the nature of it, and in their ignorance they have indulged in a lamentable dissipation of vitality. This injudicious behaviour would have been sufficient in itself, through long ages, to cause a certain amount of deterioration. But when we come to add the degrading vice of charomani, disaster is inevitable. No person is so strong that he can afford to squander his nature, for it is the most important thing in life. C'est la fleur de sang la plus pure. We recognise this in the breeding of lower animals. These, although restricted by nature, require still further restraint by man to bring them to perfection. For instance, the owner of an entire horse would never think of turning it loose into a field, in company with mares, during the rutting season. Count de Buffon tells us that in such case, the stallion, in 6 weeks, would do himself more harm than in a number of years with moderate exercise. How much more important is it, then, that moral restraint should be brought to bear upon our own species? Mark well these few important words from Ruskin. Quote, "Learn that every vicious habit and chronic disease communicates itself by descent, and that by purity of birth the entire system of the human body and soul may be gradually elevated, or by recklessness of birth degraded." Close quote. As it is in posterity that we must depend principally for regeneration, so we must study our habits, remembering that according to our virtues or our vices, so the race must wax or wane. Whether we care to acknowledge it or not, the sexual act is for the purpose of propagation alone, and when performed for the sake of mere pleasure, it becomes a vice and is attended with most disastrous results. This, then, is the solution to the great problem of the physical deterioration of the masses. We must lay bare the causes in the sight of the people, and depend upon it, the dissipation of our vitality will cease, and its conservation will begin. The end of life is not to get, but to be. By Momery. And that concludes the last chapter.